Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 40 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together and discuss interesting aspects of amateur radio technology and technology and science in general. So I hope you'll all join me on this little journey tonight, as we have in the weeks that passed. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you my usual links. Okay, if you need to reach me and you can't get me on the repeater, then email is a good idea. This would be either for mailbag questions, or if you have topics for discussion, or if you would like to share a technical puzzle with me that I could then share with the group here, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related bit of news. So my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to go directly to Paul, he has an email address as well. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, I have a link page. It has a lot of interesting articles, some of which I like to sometimes address during the technical net. Sometimes there isn't the time for it, or it's more of a visual thing. So I put up a lot of links on my link page. It's available 24/7, and it'll be there for a long time to come. So you can always avail yourself of it, and it has some interesting topics. You can get there by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you there. We have a chat room. It was a very strange chat room up until a few minutes ago. I had to bounce a couple of strangers out of it, but nevertheless, it's available for people to join and kind of discuss behind the scenes the technical net or their own technical problems or comments that they might want to share with each other. You can get there by either going to Limark's own website and following the links to the chat room, or you could just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that should bring you to directly to the chat room. In addition, I have an audio stream for the technical net because of some people needing an audio stream on the Internet for Glen Oaks. The rest of the time, I keep it live 24/7, so if you ever want to listen in to the repeater and you're not within radio range or you don't have a handy talkie on you, just type into your internet browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of our technical nets. His site, amateurradio.tv, has over a million visitors. And he has archives of our technical net going all the way back to September of 2006. So please avail yourself of it. It's full of wisdom of amateur radio operators who have moved out of the area or who have become, unfortunately, silent keys. So you can still listen to their wisdom on those archives. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, we're going to ask, as per usual, if people have any technical questions. Preferably the first few questions should be amateur radio related, but as time goes on, we'll open the floor to general science and even medicine. And, of course, we do not treat or diagnose over the radio. That's never a good idea, but we can discuss general concepts. And I'm certainly open to talking about any science-related topic. We might have a guest presenter tonight. I'm hoping that he'll be able to come and give us a very interesting discussion of why 5G frequencies are problematic near airports regarding airplanes and their radio signals and such. So I'm looking forward to that happening. That should take us to about 10:15, in which I'll turn it over to Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. That'll go for until about 11 o'clock, and I'll return and come back and wish you all well and call it a week. So that's the plan, as long as all the electronic equipment and the universe is able to let me do those things. So that's the plan. So anyone out there with any technical questions, preferably amateur radio related, but, you know, through the night we'll take more, please give me your first name and your call sign.
I certainly got something for you, Roy, and it's KD2OGB.
Into Cheyenne.
WA2VDH, John, yes.
KD2VHD, if you need assistance.
Okay, Craig, Wes, John, and Jim recognize. I'm a little curious of that comment, Jim. You're offering assistance?
In case we get into something too deep in thermodynamic star theory.
Okay, Jim, just in case. Very good. Anyone else want to put their name down? Please, feel free. Okay, very good. Well, we'll start with Craig, KD2OGB. What's your question or your topic for tonight, Craig?
Hang on just 1 second. Me and a friend on the way home on Friday had quite an interesting conversation about this, and I'd like perhaps some opinions from you and somebody else. Not looking to do it, but I would like to get some good answers. VHF, UHF on dual band antennas. Could you theoretically take an HF hamstick besides 6 meters, since that's VHF, and actually set it up to be like VHF UHF?
Okay, well, there's a whole bunch of different ways to accomplish that. I mean, basically, you could set up a doorknob to be an antenna if you have the proper impedance matching circuits. Not the most efficient, not the greatest design, but it's possible. So on a theoretical basis, yeah, sure. Also, you got to keep it in terms of, especially with something like an antenna that's designed for a 6 meter resonance, you also have to keep in mind that antennas are also resonant for odd harmonics of themselves. So as you go up the odd harmonics, you have resonance as well. So you might be able to get away with it on the basis of that. Again, these things would have multiple nodes. They'd have inefficiencies. They'd have all kinds of little problems. But in the short answer, yeah, you could do it.
Well, a really odd example, take my 20-meter hamstick, for example, on the back of my truck. Remember, it's 8 feet tall. The majority of those hamsticks are 8 feet. You have the twisted fiberglass part with that wire, with that protective coating on the outside up to the midway point, and then beyond that is the flexible steel whip part. And that's like right above the roof line. Although one of my friends said, even if you were to just plug in an HF antenna just randomly into a dual bander and just randomly key up, they say that most of that power may just reflect back into the radio, even if you do it with low power. Like 5 watts, you're going to get 3 watts into the radio and maybe only 2 watts out. And it's based off of SWR, based off of tuning, gain, things like that.
Okay, you bring up 2 points for me, at least. It's not the mechanical length of your antenna that counts so much as your electronic length of your antenna. The reason why short antennas work for HF, even though you would think they don't, is because they're electronically lengthened, usually with a length of either inductance or a capacitive hat. So it's the electronic length that allows you to resonate at HF frequencies, and it's also that electronic length that's going to have an impact upon your ability to equally attempt to resonate at shorter and shorter wavelengths of UHF and VHF. So that's one thing. Second thing is, as you mentioned, it has to do basically with standing wave ratios. How different the standing wave ratio, how high it is, affects the reflection coefficient, the amount of energy that's reflected back into your transmitter. For an open circuit, it has an infinite voussoir, and it has 100% reflection. So all that signal goes right back into your lovely little radio, and if it's not designed to handle that open circuit, it could blow out your power amplifier.
Yeah, my friend brought up the idea, like, you have to put, like, certain things, like, at the base part of it or even at the midway part, like extra wires or something like that. I don't know. And plus, there's these things somebody else said. I think it has to do with trapping, something like that. I might be wrong on that, but, yeah, I think you have to put, like, traps or something on that antenna somewhere at the bottom.
Okay, all these things do one of two things. The best approach is to somehow change the electronic length of your radiating antenna, and you can do that with traps, and you can do that with impedance matching circuits at the antenna, or you could do that with impedance circuit matching circuits farther along in your transmission line, either in the middle or at your shack. The cost you pay is the reflection losses from the transmission line. So if you were able to do it at the feed point or in the antenna, that would be the most efficient manner. You could do that again by just modifying the electronic length of the radiating antenna, or building in traps, as you mentioned, to basically cut out a lot of the excess length of the antenna from the circuit and then make it electronically short, as I mentioned earlier.
82 OGB, yeah, this was what me and my friend were talking about on the way home from a meeting. And somebody else chimed in, and they mentioned about trapping and everything, which kind of seems a little confusing to me, but yeah, you'd have to like look it up, you'd have to like see how it's really done. I assume probably more often than not, if you really wanted to try to get an antenna to really work on any kind of frequency, why not just build it? I mean, I could build an antenna that's like the same height as any other hamstick out there and use that for VHF, UHF, HF. And think about it, 8 feet in the air, that's really tall on your vehicle, and you probably would have no issues whatsoever since it's so far above your roof line. But again, all that extra stuff you got to figure out first.
AC2GS. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's kind of like putting a sixth and seventh wheel on your car. You can do it, but it doesn't quite make a lot of sense. The problem is the other way around. The problem is people who have mobile stations cannot have a full-size radiating resonant antenna on their car because it'll bang into a lot of different things and cause a lot of problems. And so they mechanically shorten it. Now, once they mechanically shorten it, they have to do something to deal with that it's too short, and they electronically lengthen it. So to take something that is artificially electronically lengthened so that it could be resonant at larger bandwidths and somehow finagle it into operating at shorter wavelengths introduces a lot of waste and expense to an antenna. In UHF and VHF antennas, the resonant lengths are easily doable by almost any mobile operator. It's not a big problem. If you want to stack multiple linear arrays of vertical half-wave, quarter-wave antennas, it can get a little bit long. But for all intents and purposes, the standard mobile UHF VHF antennas are way shorter than anything that anyone has to deal with on the HF bands. So, you know, again, it's like putting a fifth the wheel in your car.
Vehicles out there that actually have three wheels instead of four. Basically, only one.
Yeah, well, that's why I didn't say three wheels, because there are people with tricycles out there. But there's very few people, to my knowledge, with five wheels on their cars.
A fire stick, CB fire stick to work on 10 meters. I actually am looking at mine right now. It's actually known as a Firefly stick, and there's this little tip at the top that I think is tunable. And CB is usually 11 meters, but stick for maybe a few other bands, like 10 meters, for example.
You got a lot of noise all of a sudden on your signal. So if you moved your antenna to a different position away from the window or something, consider moving it back. Because when you first came on, you had a nice signal. Right now it's about 50% noise with a little bit of dropout going on. But, yeah, for the most part, there's a lot of antennas out there that are sort of cross-designed for both 10 and 11 meters because they're so close together. I have a Serio 10-meter 5/8 wave antenna that just by adjusting the whip, it has an extendable small portion of whip that can be screw locked down. And by lengthening it, you effectively get yourself a CB antenna if you're so inclined.
I find it very odd how some people have been told by the FCC, hey, your CB antenna or your radio is somehow bleeding into the amateur radio bands.
Well, I personally have had a case of that. There was a gentleman down in Coney Island, which is about a mile away, who apparently bought himself a really dirty linear amplifier that was throwing out harmonics all over the place. And so we would be sitting on our usual Sunday morning 10-meter net on 28.380 upper sideband, and we would suddenly hear the harmonics of his transmissions coming through on our frequency. So it does happen. The problem with a lot of CBers, I don't want to cast aspersions on everyone, but they like to run linear amplifiers that aren't very linear, or they like to simply goose up the power module by decreasing the resistance of a resistor that feeds into the power amplifier that takes it beyond its linear portion of its amplification. And so you get a lot of distortion and harmonics, and the signal kind of spreads out across the spectrum.
It's kind of interesting. There were like a few people that I guess got a little bit of a heads up, hey, you're somehow bleeding into the ham bands. You got to check your stuff and make sure you're not doing that, because we're getting complaints. Tone it down a little bit. Just something simple and not going too over, hey, you're in trouble for doing this.
Well, you'd be surprised, Craig. We kind of tried it with that gentleman in Coney Island. He didn't respond. And matter of fact, my contemplation on the 10-meter net drew some guy who didn't want to identify himself with any call sign, who suggested if I had a problem with that, I should change my frequency. So sometimes you would think people would be nice about it when, for some odd reason, they choose not to be.
That's what happens sometimes when you're out there. It's all good. I think that about sums everything up for now. Thank you, Roy. And I actually will keep this in my notes if I ever do something like this. I don't plan to, but it's good to have. Thank you very much. Net Control, AC2GS, KD2OGB. I'll take a listen for a little bit and come back if I have anything else in mind. Bye.
Okay, very good, Craig. Thank you for your participation. And, you know, if something comes to mind, you know where to find us. Next on my list tonight is West N2XJN. What's your topic for tonight, Wes?
Thank you very much. This is N2XJN, and I'm going to my literature right now. It is a technology that is based on waveguides and is revolutionizing the auto industry, but actually display industry. The projection, I had it here, okay. $6 billion in 2021 and projected $42.7 billion in 2022. So what actually is a technology that is able to transfer electromagnetic wave inside the waveguide to your glasses or to your front window in your car. But it has application in smart glasses, premium virtual reality, helmets, aviation, automotive, and that includes automotive, OEM, and aftermarket, so it's applicable to both. Okay, let me go to my file. Okay, got it. Okay, so there is a technology presented by Jonathan Weldon, DigiLens. DigiLens switchable Bragg grading waveguide optics for AR application. And actually how it works is that you have a small transmitter in the visible light electromagnetic wave bandwidth. It is giving you three guns, like in the old CRT, and it is shooting through the microwave waveguide that is mounted into, let's say, your glasses, to your glass that you're looking at. Now you have a choice, either looking at your glasses or you have a choice looking at the picture that is refracted from those glasses in color.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Why are you calling it a microwave waveguide? It was my understanding it was an optical waveguide.
You're absolutely right. It's a microwave guide. I wanted to say microwave guide. So we were having a discussion before the TechNet talking about waveguides, and we're not going to go to it because it's going to be boring. I'm just giving the information about it. So actually how it looks like, it is going to be like all of the dials that you have on in front of you in your car now are going to be projected to your windshield, to your front glass. And you are able to look in the road, but actually you have those dials in front of you if you want to. At the same time, you might not even need to have a driving wheel in the car because the commands could be carried on based on responses to those images. So far, they present only one way, that means displaying the images, but they also trying to have responding into those images that are halogen images. They are not existing images, but you can see them, and maneuver your car, or switch the heat, or switch the radio, or switch the phone, or do whatever is needed. As far as the driving wheel, projection is that that would be set off of the either voice commands or the switches that would be on your right-hand side, if you right-hand side or if you left it, that you would be able to operate and drive your wheel will not be needed. But those, how real it is. Well, if we believe in those projections, it is coming now to us, at least in part of it. So there is additional article that Dr. Roy sent me, but I didn't have much time to talk about it. And I would like to hear your comment, Dr. Roy, and eventually you can refer to that article. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, I was exchanging emails with Wesley. It's an interesting technology. The problem is that, you know, it's not quite that it's revolutionizing things. It has a promise to revolutionize things. It's a means of a compact, flat display augmenter, if you will, in that it's a light pipe that will take a matrix image from, you know, LEDs or some other display technology and be able to apply them onto a flat surface for things like augmented reality. That sounds very interesting but hasn't gotten off the ground yet. Apple has invested a great deal in augmented reality. I think mostly what Wesley is discussing is heads-up displays, HUD displays, that the military is very much interested in, and that can be implemented for cars. Whether they're implemented quite that way or a different way sort of depends upon technology and probably customer attitudes. A lot of guys used to their old displays are not going to like seeing indicators flash up in the middle of where they're usually looking for traffic. So there's probably going to be a little adjustment as far as that's concerned. Let me drop for a sec. Also, not really related to optical waveguides, but I saw another article, which I put on my link page, which has to do with flat lens technology. We all have cell phones for the most part, and our cell phones have this ever-growing number of bumps on the back where the camera lenses go, because you need some degree of thickness to use optical lenses. There's a new technology now using metamaterials to deposit nanostructures on flat glass and kind of give us a next-generation Fresnel lens technology that can duplicate the optical quality of regular glass without the necessary bulge. So there's a lot of great technology out there. You know, we've discussed it before on the Science Talks, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again and again and again. A lot of these things are going to change our lives in little ways and big ways, and some of them, unfortunately, won't get anywhere. They'll just kind of fade away because of some kind of innate limitation in the technology at that time as far as material sciences go. But that's my two cents on this.
So in addition, so Jonathan Waldron created a company called DigiLens, which used the switchable Bragg grading waveguide optics for AR applications. So that was the beginning. They started in 2018. And actually, what it does is, in a sense, it does not use waveguide per se, so it does have XY, but rather it uses surface wave waveguide that is based on the interface. And he has a three layers of interfaces. Those two separate. The good about it is that it's extremely done in the room like all of the electronics. It could be done on your home printer. In other words, offer ready-to-use device by also offer layers that you could have and eventually apply them to your own product. So you take a piece of glass, let's say it is LCD display. Actually, it's not the LCD display. It's just a piece of glass that would serve as LCD display or LED display. It depends what application it is. Or you take your glasses that you're wearing every day. The glass is put into the printer, and the nano coat or the layer is applied on it. Now we have those nano coating done also for sunglasses or glasses that are anti-reflectant to the sun. So this is a similar technology. The only thing is that they do it three times, and it works a very clever way. In other words, they have a vertical mirrors that are actually perpendicular or not perpendicular by an angle to the surface of your glasses that are in size of nanometers, so you cannot see them. And they actually take that light that is sent through from the gun, right, from the transmitter, and reflect them to your eye. So at your eye, you have a given color at nice, very size. And that's how they create sort of a display, digital display in front of your eye. And to actually.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just kind of give my spin on it, on this part as well. The point Wesley is kind of citing the YouTube. I have it up on my Roy's Link page. It's the next to last one. It mentions the DigiLens switchable Bragg grading waveguides. There's a whole bunch of competing optical waveguide technologies out there. Those require fabrication facilities somewhat similar to chip manufacturers, very, very, very high accuracy deposition. This technology promises to be able to be implemented using much less expensive optical materials, and also it states that it has a better ability to have a wider range of visibility, which is good for heads-up displays, but doesn't really mean that much personally to me for augmented realities, because you're going to have that little waveguide sitting right in front of your eyeball. So there's not much need for a wide perspective as far as I can perceive. Whether or not these things are scalable and whether they're as durable as the other optical waveguides is still a question. There were a lot of promises made on the YouTube from back in 2018, and yet there's very little I could find on websites about it. There were some PR announcements. There were some licensing agreements. They've gotten supposedly about $50 million from Samsung. Samsung is very much interested in the augmented reality devices. Along, Apple is doing their own thing. Microsoft has their own technology they're working on. So it's all a very exciting subject. It's still in its infancy. Augmented reality is one of those things that you hear about but you don't see much of, and I hope all this development comes to fruition, and it'll change our lives if it's able to be brought in a way that's fundamentally useful for us and cost effective. But we'll have to see. There's a lot of promising technology out there, and the problem is that you can't kind of get too excited by any of it prematurely.
I do agree with you. I didn't have much chance to dig for the position of that company as of today on the market, but that was actually interesting to me because the waveguide is a flat interface between the glass as a dielectric and another layer that is also that because that per that I that whole glass surface is on waveguide and by placing the mirror browser angle they achieve the visual effects in front of your eye. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Wesley. So I assume that's it for this interesting optical waveguide. We'll follow it. I will follow it along with augmented reality. I mean, virtual reality is a real thing, although it's very niche in my experiences still. Although guys like Mark Zuckerberg are pretty much betting the house on his metaverse, I would hate to have a virtual reality designed by him personally, though, but we'll see what the future brings.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, NASA has a pretty good augmented reality. If you download their, they got a couple of things. They have the Curiosity rover. You can, put that like in your living room, and you could be looking through your phone or your tablet, and your room would look the same, but in the middle of the room, you would see this 3D version of the Curiosity rover. I did another one outdoors with the Juno spacecraft, because that thing is so big, you have the wingspan, photovoltaic cells around 120 feet long from one end to the other. So I did it in the front yard, and it looks like my front yard is there, and there's the house in the background. There's a spacecraft sitting on the front lawn. It's pretty cool. Back to you.
Yeah, I have seen things like that. Most likely you're looking through an Apple product because, again, they're very gung-ho with it. For the most part, they've been kind of implementing it for to show what one of an Apple product would look like on your desk. So you take your little cell phone and you image your desk and it superimposes a floating Apple product on it, but it's very nice. It's a cute little trick. Ultimately, augmented reality promises to give us things like on your spectacles. For people who wear glasses or wear sunglasses, you'll look around and you'll find tags on all kinds of people and places that you pass. If you bump into someone in the street, after a second or so, their name and specs will be displayed on the side, so you never have to call some guy that you forgot his name, fella.
Yeah, very good. Okay. This is not Apple. This is Android. So no problem with that. And NASA actually uses, JPL was using it for some of their trying to develop and figure out what would work better on different satellites. It was actually experimenting using that method instead of just downloading all tons of information and looking at it page by page on your computer. I mean, they were looking at it in 3D. Thing, what would be better to do this or to do that. So they're actually starting to use it in developing future equipment for NASA.
Wouldn't that be more virtual reality? Those big goggles that people play games and such with?
Yeah, they have that too, but they were talking about the augmented where they didn't actually need the goggles. Oh, I'm sure they use that, too. But yeah, they were, at the time they were talking about the augmented one.
Oh, okay. I mean, you can actually build a much more sophisticated pseudo three-dimensional worldview with the virtual realities. The concept of augmented reality is it's a transparent lens, so you can project simulated objects onto your visual field, but frame them in a real environment. So sometimes that's very useful, and sometimes that's less useful. You know, people who have virtual reality 3D games want to be totally immersed in the experience. So, you know, looking at their living room wall while they're doing it would probably kill the buzz. So this is a place for both. There's been a lot more advances in virtual reality, both professionally. There's a lot of industrial use where, as you mentioned, people will simulate models in 3D and build them visually in a virtual environment and, you know, be able to rotate them and manipulate them and check out whether they seem to work or they don't seem to work. So there's a lot of money going into virtual and augmented reality. Some people at this point can't really take virtual reality. The refresh rate apparently is a little too slow for them, and they start to develop nausea because the visual cues of where they are in space don't map on to their semicircular canals in their inner ears. And so, you know, their eyes are saying they're moving in one direction, and their ears are telling them they're standing still. Some people just can't tolerate it, unfortunately. So hopefully with better improved technology, greater field of view, a higher frame rate, there'll be less of that in the future. But it's an amazing technology, and I'm really looking forward to what these people come up with. I'm sure it's going to be loads of fun to play with.
I've tried the virtual reality with the International Space Station on the inside of the space station. Unfortunately, the space station was, you know, this one was not updated yet, so you couldn't go, you know, through all the different modules. But, you know, you went through some of them, and I had the same problem. I couldn't stand up, you know. I mean, forget about it. I tried again, but I had the same kind of problem. I was ready to keel over. I thought it was great. Back to you.
Yeah, it's great technology, and at this point, it's unclear whether they could just kind of make improvements in the specs and limit the number of people who just can't tolerate it. You know, even among it's relatively more popular for younger people where they use it for gaming environments and streaming and all kinds of virtual chat and all kind of stuff. And even they sometimes have difficulties operating the equipment. They just put it on, and they suffer a severe case of nausea from it. So I've never experienced it. It's one of those things on my very, very safe bucket list. I don't want to jump out of planes and a bungee jump, but I would like to try that technology out. Haven't had a chance to do it yet. I just hope it doesn't make me nauseous as well.
WOT, comment.
Unable to. If you're standing, it's tough. I think if you had one that was, you know, where you were sitting, that would be better, you know. But the idea is, you know, you should be able to walk through where, you know, whatever you're looking at. And you could grab the walls, you could push yourself off one way or the other. Excuse me. And it works really good. But no, not nauseous at all. Just, you know, get the feeling you're going to fall over.
Okay, yeah, it's the motion that's the problem. And the problem is that biologically we're designed with two mechanisms really to give us a good sense of where we are in three-dimensional space. To a degree, we have a proprioception. We know where the joints of our bones are pointing. That's why you could close your eyes and be able to touch your nose with both fingers without a problem. But the two primaries is your visual center, that tells you where you are and also your semicircular canals inside your ear. And they're supposed to agree. When they don't agree, that's where you start to get the problems. Some people can kind of inhibit their signals from one of them, and they take to virtual reality like water, and other people can't. You either have problems with mobility or you have severe problems with nausea. You know, it ranges across population groups.
Okay, very good. Yeah, you got these two things in your hands, you know, both your hands, and what you're looking at it all. It looks like white gloves. It looks like your hands, but of course it's not. It's real. It's pretty cool. You got to try it.
Yeah, it's definitely on my list. Chris, KD2WOT, you wanted to make a comment?
Yes, good evening, Roy and everyone else on the net. Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I mean, there was a commercial product that's actually still out there, I think. It was called Google Glass. With that, it was basically transparent and, you know, as you pointed your head, it would kind of decode whatever you were looking at, I guess.
Yeah, it never really made it to an actual commercial product. It was one of those things that Google engineers were working on, and they released a developer beta that cost a lot of money to developers. And then they quietly killed the project, and lately there are hints that they've brought it back to life once again, because there's objects that look a lot like Google Glass that have been photographed. So it might get a second life.
KD2WOT. Yeah, I just looked on Google, and it indicates that it is available. It looks like it costs about $1,000.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, though, there's no real commercial application. It's kind of like a gadget that they'll give you the programming hooks for it, and you can make. Make software yourself. Lots of luck with that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Give it back to the net control.
Okay. Very good, Chris. There's a whole bunch of interesting gadgets out there. For one reason or another, I think the companies just aren't interested in commercializing it for the general public. And I had that problem at one time with fingerprint readers. They end up kind of sequestering it without any software. They offer as a development kit for third parties, and they give you the software to develop your own programs, but they stop actually updating their software themselves for the general public. So I've had at least two fingerprint readers that simply stopped working because although the company still existed and they were still offering it as OEMs to big companies having internal security devices, you couldn't run it with their software because they didn't want to maintain it. So curious how some gadgets kind of end up in little cubbyholes someplace. Anyway, next on my list is John WA2VDH. What's your question or topic tonight, John?
Oh, hi. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone on the net. Hoping everyone is in good health. Question is on Flex Radio. Specifically, and also IQ data in general. I was wondering how your Flex Radio gets the IQ data. The way I've generally seen it done is the analog signal comes in, goes to two mixers. One mixer gets a sine wave local oscillator. The other one, they shift the local oscillator 90 degrees, get the cosine wave local oscillator. and then the output of those two mixes go to two separate A to D converters, and that gives you your I data and your Q data. Is that the way your Flex radio does it? Related question is, can that also be done by just using two separate A to D converters and letting the sampling pulses be out of phase with each other? Would that also achieve IQ data? Go ahead.
Well, yes, that would. I do not believe, though, my Flex 6700 does that. I believe that as long as you have a great deal of computational power, you're able to actually generate your own IQs from simple trigonometric functions, given the original digitized RF stream.
Oh, you mean after it's been digitized, you can get the IQ data from that?
Yes, yes, exactly. It's not a difficult equation. It just, you know, requires a little bit computation. You know, so there are others that implement the method that you mentioned before, but, you know, as long as you have these field programmable gate arrays that are monsters of floating point operations, it's very simple to do, apparently.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, because once it's digitized, I didn't think that gives you that sort of already pre-combined it. Usually the ways I've seen that they separate them is you use two different phases of local oscillator, like a sine wave and a cosine wave, to give you the I and Q. But yeah, I'll have to look into that some more. Okay, that was basically my question.
Okay, very good. You know, I mean, the earliest reports of amateur radio related software defined radios utilize something called a Talo detector, so that the signal would go through and be broken out into both the I and Q components. But that was not one of those things that were designed to be plugged straight into the front end of a radio. So that was the way, I think that was implemented someplace in the IF stage.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is my NRD515 receiver here, it has an IF output on it. And, you know, I was thinking of playing around with taking that output and digitizing it. You know, so I'd have something at the IF range where I could play around with, do some experimentation with it.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
When you put in an IF filter, is that sort of like the same thing, the IF filter and the bandwidth of the receive signal?
Well, no. The bandwidth of the receiver itself can be incredibly much wider than the IF, the intermediate frequency used in IF stages. The IF stages narrow it and select for a subset of the bandwidth. So IF filters are going to narrow the full capability of a given front end of a receiver's bandwidth.
QSL. Well, this radio, when it has no filter, it's bandwidth for SSB, 5 kilohertz, and with the filter, it's 3.3, so it's a wide single sideband filter known to make the radio sound really good.
Okay, that's not quite what we were talking about as opposed to RF and IF. Now you're talking about the detection circuits of the detector sampling to a given audio range of frequencies.
QSL. Well, you know, I was trying to find, you know, some radio that offers a best possible receive audio. I guess most of them transmit the same, don't you think?
Not really. There's different IMD. There's different distortions that different transmitters are subject to. So there are better transmitters and worse transmitters. You could also adjust the bandwidth of the transmission. I think I mentioned that I can do extended single sideband on my Flex, and other radios are capable of adjusting it. But for the most part, what you're talking about are the aspects of the detector going into the audio amplifier. The IF stages and mixers don't really affect that much the bandwidth of the received and transmitted audio modulated signal. So that's the detector and the audio amplifiers.
QSL. But the bandwidth of the single sideband receive signal on two different radios, one of them sounds a whole lot better, and I really don't know what this means. You know, how do you figure out, you know, to get a radio that doesn't hurt your ears and transmit well? And I guess maybe it's like trial and error, do you think?
AC2GS. Well, ultimately, you have to decide on the factors that are important to you and that you're sensitive to. Some people's hearing isn't as good as others. They're more tolerant of a lot of distortion that other people aren't. And for different purposes, you want more or less distorted audio. A lot of times, people who do a lot of distance and contesting would prefer a harsher voice that's more recognizable, that people will possibly respond to faster. And so they put a lot of compression and expansion and crank it up for DX, and they find it to be very effective. Other people find it to be terribly fatiguing. That's the case where people choose not to go for the fidelity, but simply for the biggest impact on the other person. So, like all things, it depends upon what you're interested in and your abilities to appreciate them. Some people are tone deaf, and there's a lot of things that some people hear they blissfully are unaware of.
Roy, I can't really do anything about what other people send my way in terms of radio signals. So, you know, I can only try to improve it on my end.
Well, that's always the case. But that's why there are digital signal processors and equalizers. And if you've ever seen some QRZ pages, there are guys with more racks of audio equipment than they have radio equipment. They're both using it for transmission purposes and often for reception, where they're tweaking and adjusting all kinds of variables on the audio stream that they're receiving to serve their own purpose. So, you know, if you have enough time and enough understanding of acoustics and audio, you can manipulate a transmitted signal a great deal. You can't really add any information, but you can adjust the information that's provided in all manner of different ways.
QSL. But for the ICOM IC718 entry-level transceiver, there is a Collins pipe crystal filter for IF and the single sideband audio. This particular filter they don't make anymore. I wonder why.
Well, probably it's not cost effective. It's a somewhat expensive design, if I remember correctly. And they'd much rather use quick and dirty digital tricks to accomplish vaguely similar things. But, you know, mechanical filters, you know, just in the same way that there was a big company that manufactured quartz for oscillating circuits that went out of business just because the demand is not quite as big as it was.